Good morning. Today is Tuesday, the 16th of April. Hopefully everybody got their taxes in that were supposed to get their taxes in yesterday. Joining us this morning.
Check.
Oh, got checked. Yeah, but you crossed your fingers.
Right.
Does that mean?
Yeah. You know, I.
You kind of sort of think so?
Well, you know, nobody wants the IRS to look too closely.
No, I don't want to learn how to spell that either. Joining us this morning from the UC Cooperative Extension is not Yana. She's out being superstar somewhere, huh?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Always is.
Yeah. Good. She's trained you well. Eddie Tanner, good morning, sir.
Good morning.
You ready for your question?
Sure.
Really?
Well.
Everybody says that, like, with such enthusiasm.
I don't think I'm ever going to get one of these right, but I'm ready for the question.
All right. Okay. Here we go. Why do we call a leg injury a Charlie horse?
Yeah, see, stumped on this one.
Continue the trend here, huh?
Yeah, well, it goes back to those, you know, all the way back to Abraham and his favorite horse, Charlie.
Yeah, Charlie the horse, I remember it. It was in Romans 14.
Am I close?
No, it starts out, the phrase Charlie horse has its roots in baseball. Little early on your throw there. At the beginning of the 20th century, groundskeepers often used old and lame horses to pull the equipment used to keep the playing field in top condition. The Baltimore Orioles had a player named Charlie Esper, who, after years of injuries, walked with pain. Because his limp reminded his teammates of the groundskeeper's lame horse, they called Esper Charlie horse. There you go.
All right. Learn something new every time.
A little bit. Now, if you had that in a baseball trivia tournament, I don't think anybody would get it. But it would be a cool one to stump everybody with. Boy, that's two puns, and I've slid them both past you. Stump?
Right.
Yeah, okay, fine.
It's still morning. I'm still waking up.
This time of the year, is it too late? Or are a lot of the large grower, you know, the large farmers, not physically, I mean, think more acreage, is it too late for them to start the fertilizing process? Have they already started fertilizing? Should they be if they're growing? Well, let's go with the federally legal stuff to start.
Sure.
With. Is it too late to put that in, or is it too early because we're in theory going to get more rain?
Yeah, no. Most of it's the time that a lot of that is happening, right? A lot of fertility happens pre-plant during ground prep for planting. You know, earlier applications can sometimes just mean a loss of nutrients to leaching. So no, now's the time that a lot of that's happening. You know, the more dialed into your fertilizing you are, the more you might want to tailor it to the different growth stages of the plant. So maybe it's a little bit pre-plant and then more supplied as the plant's growing, just depending on that crop's need. You know, the one locally, if you're thinking about amending your soils, the one thing that helps to do farther in advance is if you're adjusting the pH with lime, with ground limestone or oyster shell flowers. That it's really nice to get that in the fall.
Oyster shell, got it.
Flower. Yeah, that was a slip.
That was
a slip on my part.
Flour.
Yeah. Yep.
Not flower.
Yeah,
because I've never seen a flower coming out of an oyster shell. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, oyster shell flour or ground limestone to raise pH, which is a common need in our soils around here.
You see that pretty regularly, the white trails all over the dirt.
Yeah, so getting that in the fall and letting the rains work that in is really helpful. But the rest of the nutrients, now's a great time to be thinking about it.
When we see in the local nurseries, rose, I guess, would be one, you know, the rose one, or the one that is good for the grass, or good to, you see the numbers on the bottom. I would imagine if you put the wrong one on the right plant, you're going to kill the plant, or it just won't grow as well. Or what happens if you kind of cross?
Yeah, I would say usually it's not that dramatic. You know, most of our plants are generally using the same nutrients, but just plants do have their preferences for acidity and for different, you know, amounts of the various nutrients. And that's what those kind of tailored fertilizers are trying to get at. But our plants also just get a lot of their nutrients from the base that's already in the soil. So especially if you have been building a healthy soil over time and adding compost and organic matter that are going to release nutrients slowly, you know, those get supplemented with the fertilizers you add in each year, and, you know, together, pretty likely to get the plant what it needs.
You know, as I do, that there are militant composters.
I may be one of them.
Yeah. I will never take from a bag, blah, blah, blah. I'll never use this product or that product. Is that short-sighted or wise or something else?
You know, I think it's a mix of both, really. You know, the wisdom is that, you know, compost does a lot more than just provide nutrition to plants. It can promote healthy soil structure and healthy soil, a microbiome, you know, a diverse living soil that really can help crops grow and keep plants healthy. But compost is highly variable as well. So there is.
Yeah, it really depends on what you're, yeah. You put corn cobs in there. It's going to be a little different than if you put in lettuce.
So you might not be getting your plants what you need if you're only using compost, or depending on what that compost is.
50-50 with a general or what?
Yeah. Again, that kind of depends on your starting point. So a lot of the organic farmers around here, for instance, have been building that soil through compost and cover cropping for many years. They have a really kind of well-established base.
Well, they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the home guy or gal that is okay, fine, and
they
have lawn clippings in the back corner of the fence.
Sure. Right. So that's only going to do so much for the garden. But over time, it does add up. I think the big lesson there when adding compost is just not mixing anything into the soil that's not ready to be mixed in. And by that, I mean anything that's like woody or fibrous, has a lot of carbon in it.
You mean chunky?
Yeah, chunky, but especially like woody and dry, because those are going to tie up nitrogen in the soil if they get mixed in. And that's going to stunt your plant growth.
So it's not like you're putting a secret magic bullet that's really going to help out in 10 years. You're basically mucking it up for the next 10 years.
Yeah, right? Yeah. It'll take a couple of years to rebalance.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:09.
Murphy's Markets has everything you need to get through your day the healthy way. From drinks to snacks and everything in between, right now, Amy and Brian coconut water is only $1.99. Brew Dr. Kombucha drinks are also just $1.99. And Annie's homegrown products are $2.49. A 6-ounce Yoplait yogurt is only 79 cents. And don't forget about Chicken of the Sea tuna, 4 for $5. Get a boost for your day by stopping by Murphy's Markets. More than a grocer, your neighbor since 1971.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:24. We're back talking shop this morning with Eddie Tanner from the Cooperative Extension out at Spruce Point. Eddie's the farm advisor. Is there any movement at all to having standing farmers markets? You know, I don't know. Maybe we don't have enough people here. Maybe we don't have enough farmers here. But in some other areas in the country that I'm familiar with, there's like the open-air warehouse. You just got some uprights, covered area, and it's like a standing, pick your day, they're there. Your hours are normal, traditional hours, you know, 8 to 6 kind of thing. And those that want to, I guess they must rent booth space. I don't know, that part I'm unaware of. You set up, but you don't have to break down. You don't have to haul in. It sells through. You don't have whatever you do with leftovers that you don't sell at that farmer's market in town. It seems more of a business enterprise rather than, I don't want to say a social statement, but you know, kind of, sort of. So why hasn't something like that happened here? Because there seems to be such strong demand and willingness to support local farmers.
Sure. No, that's a great question. I mean, you do see that model in cities around the world where there are kind of permanent markets where you know, people.
Well, I'm
know
not thinking
to come.
Like in Asia where, you know, you got two-foot walkways.
But that is where you see it.
But yeah, I mean, because they've got so many people, and, sure. and land is tough to come by.
And I think that's, you know, it does have something to do with our geography here too. You know, the goal of the farmers markets has been to sort of kind of really, you know, drive people to kind of a weekly event. You know, they know when it happens. It's kind of an outing they can go to.
Yeah, more of a social event rather than a buying trip.
You know, happily it's both for the producers.
We hope.
And so I think the goal so far of the farmers markets in our county is to spread that out geographically. So there, you know, people can, you know, there's farmers markets in Southern Humboldt and Fortuna and Eastern Humboldt, you know, in Willow Creek. And so between the, I think that's why we maybe just don't have the density to have it in kind of one spot all the time. But I know the producers would love not to have to pack up and pack in every time, and you know, it's a tiring day.
If Eureka is what I've been told, about 80,000 during the daytime, weekday time, I would think that that's getting halfway close to critical mass. But it, you know, if it's not economically viable, I get it. But you kind of go to where the customers are.
Yeah,
if the customers are around the Bay Area, I would think that they would want to have. Unless the outlets that they've got now, in addition to the farmers market,
exactly.
are profitable enough yeah. that it's not worth endangering that relationship.
Well, I think it's that, and our, you know, our residents have a lot of great choices for getting produce. You know, so there is a lot of support for buying directly from local farmers through farmers markets, but we also have a lot of great grocery stores, and you know, as far as consumer preference goes. You know, not everybody's going to make the journey to the farmer's market.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, there's people that don't want dirt on their potatoes, too.
Mm-hmm.
I want hydroponic tomatoes and potatoes. What? What about some of those technologies, though, like hydroponics? I know it's not really a technology. It's more of a system or a process. Are we going to start seeing those in the farmers markets, or the results of those in farmers markets, or is it starting to happen in metropolitan areas where maybe they don't have dirt?
Yeah, that's definitely the piece right there. So here in Humboldt County, we do have a demonstration hydroponic operation run through the County Office of Education.
Yeah, it's still out of Redwoods, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah, really neat operation, involves students in the learning process. And produces food too. I had some basil and cucumbers from their greenhouses this winter. Really tasty.
Oh, sure.
So out of season produce that, you know, other local
basil that doesn't need to
be
cleaned.
Right.
Gotta love that.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is really neat, but it does, you know, it does cost more to produce that way generally. So you know, scale matters a lot, and markets matter a lot. So that's why you do see it more in these, you know, dense urban areas where there isn't a lot of land or where there isn't, you know, a climate somewhere not too far away where you can just ship it from.
Right. And you've got a population that is willing to pay that premium.
Right.
For the, I would imagine that, well, has organics been clearly defined yet?
It has. Yeah, there's a national definition for organic, and right now it does not include hydroponic.
It's really?
Yeah. Yeah, although there are...
That's interesting.
There are practices that are similar to hydroponic, like soil-less medium growing, so growing plants in potting soil and giving them nutrition, you know, through their irrigation, that can qualify as organic.
You just have to have some dirt somewhere?
Yeah.
Basically is what
yeah,
it's
and that's actually one of the debates within sort of the organic community. There is definitely a debate over whether that type of growing should still be considered organic, but currently it is, as long as the inputs are registered as organic inputs.
Yeah, well, that's kind of like the whole tracing concept, isn't it? I know it's kind of out of your bailiwick, but if you have an organic dairy farm, don't you have to do all that same kind of documentation?
Sure, yeah, documentation, record keeping, making sure that the supply chain is that everything you're bringing in.
And that goes to the fertilizer
uh-huh.
of the grass or hay or whatever that is that the cows eat.
Right.
It probably sounds like somebody's ox would be gored if hydroponics were defined as being organic. Funny how it all boils down to that kind of stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right, you don't have to say the political stuff. I know it. KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:30.
Something big.
Okay, it's a nice ride.
It's going to happen.
Stand by playback.
And now.
Meet Radio.
I keep forgetting I'm president.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And these kids who come, they become Americans before a lot of Americans become Americans.
Now, here's your host, Lars Larson.
Hey there, it's Lars Larson. Join me for the Lars Larson Show, weeknights 10 to midnight. Honestly provocative talk radio on KINS.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:34. We're back talking shop this morning with Eddie Tanner, the farm advisor at the UC Cooperative Extension. Eddie, as you look at this time of the year for a lot of us, if I guess this weekend is supposed to be kind of not wet.
Yeah.
Put it that way. We're getting close to whatever backyard garden thing we might be doing. If it's tomatoes, we're buying the tomato rounds. If it's the strawberries, whether we're doing hanging or in the flats. Getting ready for stuff. What are some of the basic things we should do? I mean, is topsoil necessary for the plant? Or can we just get dirt and augment it ourselves? Do you stick it in? I guess I use some of the brand stuff. You just slam it in a bag of Miracle-Gro? What do you do? How do you do it? And easy to remember stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, depending on where in the region you live, a lot of us do already have good topsoil. So, you know, if your topsoil is a nice brown color and has some depth to it, chances are you can amend that pretty easily and grow into that either with some kind of balanced fertilizer or some chicken manure that's kind of already aged.
But in most of the subdivisions, it goes, what, about 6 inches down?
Yeah, right.
Well, so depending the roots, on the history. The roots go deeper than six. I mean, even if you're doing carrots,
yeah.
It's going down into whatever was there originally.
Sure. So if you don't have a lot of soil, you might either be limited in what you can grow or you can build up from there. And when people do build raised beds, I often do recommend using primarily topsoil. There generally are, you know, landscape supply companies that have topsoil that's already been screened. And what you're looking for if you're bringing in topsoil is color. You know, when that topsoil is dry, you want to see kind of brown, maybe gray, but not so much red or yellow, because that's indicating that that was kind of floodplain fertile soil as opposed to forest soil.
Or seeing clay.
Yeah. Yeah. So color is a really good indicator when you're purchasing topsoil.
But it's really fluffy when you put it in, right? And then you water it down and it goes.
It'll compact.
Yeah, you know, you're down to about 25% of what you started with. It appears that way.
Yeah, well, with topsoil, it will settle, but not quite that dramatically.
Yeah,
I know. But you can, you know, and then supplement that. So, if I'm filling a raised bed, I think, you know, at least 70 up to 80% topsoil, that's really the base of what I would fill a bed with. And that last, you know, 20%, that's where you can add in, you know, aged compost, aged manures, and even some potting soils, because it does kind of make the ground more friable, just easier to work as a gardener.
Yeah, I would think, you know, sometimes, you know, you try to keep it fluffy.
Yeah.
Technical word. But as the summer goes on and you water more and more, it compacts down. Is the compactness problematic? Or do we just like to see fluffy because fluffy looks softer and it's easier for us to play around with the trowel rather than having to dig into it and put things in?
Sure. Yeah, it's a balance. You know, if it's too fluffy, you might have so much airspace in there that you're not getting good root contact with your plants. So, and the other thing about, you know, so if you're filling a raised bed entirely with potting soil, for instance, it's really loose and fluffy, but it's also really hard to keep that evenly moist. So it'll tend to dry out and then it's really hard to re-wet. And that's a challenge that I've seen a lot. I mean, anybody who's kind of tried to keep things, large plants alive in containers with potting soil has probably experienced that. They just get, once they get dry, they can get really dry.
Yeah, it's almost like a hard pack.
Yeah, so that's why I think topsoil makes that good kind of foundational base, and then you can build that sort of looseness and fluffiness by just promoting soil structure, which happens faster than you might think with the, you know, earthworm activity and other microorganisms kind of feeding.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, you know, you can buy bags of ladybugs. I've never seen a bag of worms.
You can buy bags of composting worms.
Oh, can you?
Yeah, red wigglers that'll speed up the composting process.
Is that
process
like a special order? Where do you?
Some of the garden stores will carry them.
Okay.
But,
you just put those in the raised bed, and then you've got
ones are actually for compost piles, and they won't thrive in the garden bed.
Oh, yeah, they attack roots then, huh?
Well, they won't attack. They just won't. They'll die. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, they like it in the compost pile and not so much in the soil. But if you've been adding a lot of that compost to the soil, then the earthworms are going to show up. They're so common.
How do they get into a raised bed?
Good question.
I mean, if you're up on the legs.
Right.
I mean, I'm thinking raised bed so you don't have to bend over raised bed, not just a 2x12 perimeter.
Yeah, no, that's they're you know, widespread, and their eggs are hiding around, and they generally find their way.
Okay.
You know,
so I wouldn't think, you know, it's not like seeds where birds drop them. I don't think birds are dropping too many worms as they're flying overhead.
No, but chances are you're bringing them in from somewhere.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, either they're in the soil already or they're coming in with the compost that you're bringing in.
Oh, so even the bag stuff that you've got?
Yeah, a lot of it
has... It's sterilized?
So a lot of those commercial composting processes do reach a certain temperature time threshold, which will wipe out certain pathogens, but it doesn't kill everything, and you really wouldn't want it to.
Right.
So.
Right. But, huh.
Yeah.
And worms are
they're going to show up. Yeah, chances are the earthworms will find their way, and as long as you keep giving them something to feed on in that soil, some organic matter that you're adding to that topsoil and potting soil mix that you have in your raised bed, over time that's going to continue to cycle nutrients and release nutrients and form a more structured soil.
As long as you keep fish out of it, you're okay, right? KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:40.
Hearty and healthy foods are abundant at Murphy's Markets. USDA Choice Boneless Beef Chuck Roast is now $5.99 a pound. USDA Choice New York Strip Steak, $15.99 a pound. And USDA Grade A Boneless Skinless Chicken Thighs are only $3.99 a pound. Complement this with a Greek salad, now just $7.99 a pound, topped with Kraft salad dressing for only $3.75 for a 16-ounce bottle. Murphy's Markets, more than a grocer, your neighbor since 1971.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:45. We're back talking shop this morning with Eddie Tanner. Eddie, spring gardening or the home gardener, what are the common mistakes? What do we do that either limits it or severely impacts either the positive reinforcement to do it again next year or the plants all die? I mean, I would think number one is you buy the wrong plant.
Yeah.
Something that is not designed to grow in whatever the microclimate is that you're in. You know, if you're on the water, that's different than living in Blue Lake. Even though we all may be in Zone 9, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, or just getting the plant in at the wrong time. So that's one thing that's, you know, it's a good time of year to get the garden going, but it's not summer yet. So definitely something to keep in mind is we have our cool season crops and our warm season crops, and those warm season plants like tomatoes, cucumbers, squashes, green beans, it's early for them right now. So you know, you might be excited and you might be wanting to get an early start on those.
But you're not going
to
be happy.
Yeah, they're not going to grow much if you put them out now, unless you can give them some kind of protection. So cover them with a row cover or some kind of plastic to kind of augment that growing environment. But it is a great time to get a lot of the cool season plants in. And I guess the kind of first tip that I have for this time of year is just trying to figure out what's happening with your soil moisture. Kind of every soil has a sweet spot moisture-wise that it wants to crumble, you know, that it's easier to work.
Okay.
And if you're trying to force it this time of year, you know, this last rain wasn't too heavy and we had a nice dry week before that. But after a rain, you know, especially in spring when soils are still wet, they can be wet, and if you try to kind of force that to break up and crumble, it just doesn't want to do it. It's going to stick and smear.
Either mud or dirt clods.
Yeah,
right.
Right.
Yeah.
So moisture makes a huge difference in how easy it is to work the ground and to get good results from working up a garden bed.
What are, you know, there are those tomatoes, what, 81 days? I don't know why I remember 81 days. But there are some, you put them in, let's say, in July. Okay. You get the
flowers. July's a little late.
Okay, or June, let's say June. You get the flowers. And then you get a couple of tomatoes, but you got a whole bunch of greenies. And they keep coming on and coming on, but they never ripen.
Yeah.
Is it because we put the plant in too late? It's in the wrong place? Are these things that prolific that they just kind of keep going even after a prime time?
Well, a little bit of both. Tomatoes are, you know, a really fun crop to grow, but here, if you're around Humboldt Bay, we are not in a great climate for tomatoes. So
Yeah,
I mean, the warmer,
or Humboldt Hill?
Yeah, if you get a little warmer, it makes a difference. And so, you know, along the coast, the ones people have the most success with are the cherry tomatoes. They do seem to ripen a little better.
Which other one would you want?
Oh, you know, nice, juicy, slicing
No. You go to the store for those guys. The hanging ones that are in the sun, and you just nail a couple of them, and it's kind of like you're having candy.
But even the cherry tomatoes, you know, they'll grow, they'll ripen some fruit, but we have a classic problem when the kind of fog rolls in the early fall, and then all the leaves turn black. We're in a great environment for late blight, for a fungal disease, Phytophthora infestans, blows in on the wind.
That was the Latin thing you just said, right?
Yeah, and it spreads really quickly through, you know, host plants, which are tomatoes, potatoes primarily.
And roses?
Nope, thankfully.
That's a different
yeah,
kind.
That's a
okay.
different one. And can turn those plants black in just a couple of nights. So that's often what happens is people have these tomatoes, they're starting to ripen, and then the next day the plants are just like
you get drunk. Yeah.
Yeah. The good news is that in the last 10 years or so, plant breeders have come up with some pretty highly resistant varieties to late blight. And they include some really tasty tomatoes.
Oh.
So, you know, the first thing I would say, if you can, is make a warmer climate for your tomatoes.
Is that like the plastic sheet over them?
Yeah, greenhouses, plastic sheets, or even just like the warmest microclimate in your yard. So protected by a fence from wind and getting some south radiance.
Does wind impact? I mean, you know, if it's too strong, obviously it does. But is wind a variable to be considered?
It definitely cools things down. You know, when the winds are, if you're in an exposed spot where the winds are strong, it'll dramatically, slow down plant
growth. So it's a temperature thing. It's not wind damage in the traditional sense.
Right, unless it's really fierce and your plants are.
Well, okay, if they're flying across the deck, you're not worried too
much.
But
yeah,
about
it
that.
Does lower that temperature. And here, especially in the spring, we're already pretty cool. So creating those microclimates, but really for those tomatoes, if you are going to kind of continue to struggle to grow them outside near the coast, is choose those resistant varieties. It makes a huge difference.
And you can find those by just doing a little bit of research?
Yeah. If you search for late blight resistant tomatoes, you'll have several options now.
I mentioned roses too. You know, there's a gazillion roses. Are there, obviously there are some that are more suited for certain climates, and they're bred that way. But what are some of the mistakes we have with those? Because I know a lot of folks are putting roses in this time of the year also.
Yeah, roses are great plants. I mean, it is a good time to get them in. You know, when you're planting, you definitely want to make sure that you're firming that soil well around the roots. So anytime you're planting a perennial plant, a woody plant, you know, you want to dig a nice loose hole for it, but then when you put it back in, so one of kind of some of the classic mistakes would be either not putting that plant to the right depth. So either kind of
too deep
or a little too shallow. Definitely don't want to expose the roots and don't want to make them work too hard by being buried either. And then really firming that soil in around those roots to get good soil contact and then giving it a nice thorough watering after planting. So that's kind of some of the basic mechanics for getting a new plant in and getting it off to a good start.
So just kind of stomp it down or push it down, whatever it is.
Yeah. I really recommend, you know, putting gloves on and really actually getting your fingers in there. So in the planting
gloves.
Hole, make sure the plants can spread out. Helps with roses especially.
Yeah. Hopefully it's the thicker ones rather than those little thin things that you tear through. But are we just ignorant about it or in too much of a hurry?
Yeah.
Typically.
Yeah, I'd say maybe it's more of the latter. Yeah, take your time and, you know, really settle that plant in and get it off to a good start. You know, so they're going to need a lot of water right after establishment, you know, if the rains have stopped especially. And, you know, one thing that kind of used to be a really common practice for a lot of like fruit trees and perennial plantings, people would kind of dig the hole and amend the planting hole, you know, add fertilizer to the planting hole or a lot of compost. But there is a risk if you do that, that you're actually just kind of creating basically a pot where the plant doesn't want to stretch out into the soil around it because it has all these, you know, all these extra nutrients.
Oh, mommy, it's
right
too cold
it.
Outside. I'm going to stay inside. Yeah.
Right. So the, you know, the recommended practice really is to not amend the soil that's going back into the planting hole.
Oh, really? You just have chunked it up?
Yeah.
So it's a little looser.
And then scratch fertilizer into the surface.
Really? Not even mix it in at all?
Yeah, let the water wash it in over time. Water and organisms will work it in over time.
That's true for like trees and things
like
that?
It is, yeah. Yeah, and I think the kind of one of the things to remember is that you want those roots to grow out so the zone that you're amending with your fertilizer, with your compost, you want to kind of think about that in kind of increasing bands.
Get
as the
outside
plant grows.
The hole.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. That's like carrots at the end of the stick, right? You get those roots out. Interesting. Number one takeaway when you're buying, price point, variety, what should it be?
Yeah, variety is huge.
Fair enough. Have fun this afternoon down south.
Yeah, thanks.
Mr. Expert. See everybody tomorrow.